Franco Harris, that famous Immaculate Reception. You hear Kirk Gowdy's broadcast of that play at the beginning of every episode of The Game Before the Money. Franco Harris passed away this week at age 72. The Steelers planned to retire his number this weekend as they play the Raiders 50 years after the Immaculate Reception. Going to give you a history of that play in the next segment. And you'll hear an interview clip from Steelers assistant coach Lionel Taylor, who actually called the play. And you'll learn a lot from him. I'll also tell you about another legendary NFL game that happened on the same day as the Immaculate Reception. And two more legendary NFL games that happened on Christmas Eve in the same year. But the bulk of this show will be an interview with Randy Cross, offensive lineman for the San Francisco 49ers during the Bill Walsh glory years. You'll hear him talk about another famous play, the catch, as well as his time at UCLA and winning the Rose Bowl with the Bruins. The Bruins head coach for that game was Dick Vermeil. That was in the 1976 Rose Bowl, and it turns out that Randy Cross also had a deep connection with the UCLA team that won the 1966 Rose Bowl. So you'll want to hear that for sure, as well as some real insight into the catch made by Dwight Clark in the 1981 NFC Championship game and John Taylor's game-winning touchdown in Super Bowl 23. Merry Christmas and happy holidays, everybody. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Right, the Immaculate Reception game was played on December 23rd, 1972. It was the first playoff game ever won by the Steelers in franchise history, going back all the way to when they were founded in 1933. Now, the famous play from that game is, of course, Franco Harris catching a deflected pass and scoring the game-winning touchdown with just seconds left in the game. Now, right before that, the Raiders had a great play, and that would have been the major highlight. Raiders quarterback Ken Stabler, who had come into the game to relieve their starting quarterback, Daryl LaMonica, Stabler ran for a long touchdown late in the game to give the Raiders a 7-6 lead. The Steelers got the ball back, knowing that a field goal could win the game. And then the Steelers got into a situation where they faced a fourth down out of field goal range with under a half minute left. A while back, I got to interview Lionel Taylor. A lot of you might recognize his name for his historic season as a receiver for the Denver Broncos, becoming the first player to ever catch 100 passes in a season. He did that in the old AFL days. He was also an assistant coach for Chuck Knoll on the 1972 Steelers. When I asked him about the Immaculate Reception, he told me that he actually made the play call. Here's what he had to say.
I called the play, and it didn't work. You know, I called a hook to Barry Pearson, and Bradley was trying to get a first down. You know, we needed a first down. And I didn't realize Bradshaw was under so much pressure that he slipped. They had him almost tackled back, and he slipped, and he fired the ball. And I don't know if it was Tatum or somebody. They collided there, and that ball went back. And Franco made a great, great catch. And that was it. That was so. Yeah, I was there.
And you called the pattern.
Yeah, but that didn't work. What are you talking about? We were just trying to get a first down. You know, we had to have that first down. We had to give the ball up. Well, you know, Mr. Rooney was in the elevator coming down. He thought we had lost the game. He didn't know we'd won the game when he got down to the locker room.
And that is indeed true. Steelers owner Art Rooney didn't see the play. He didn't see the Immaculate Reception. He was on the elevator going down to the locker room. When speaking to reporters after the game, Franco Harris said that his assignment on the play was to block, but when quarterback Terry Bradshaw started to feel the heat of the Raiders' pass rush, Harris decided to run downfield to hopefully give Bradshaw another receiving outlet. And the rest, as they say, is history. And what's important to remember about that game is that Franco Harris was a rookie that year in 1972. You think about a guy starting his career doing that, that's pretty amazing. And Ken Stabler was not a well-known NFL player at the time. He was known for his college quarterbacking days at Alabama. But remember, Daryl LaMonica started this game for the Raiders. So even though Oakland lost that game, it also put Ken Stabler on the map. So you had two future Hall of Famers making memorable plays at the end of a playoff game that ends up being one of the most famous games in NFL history. A lot of people think that the Steelers must have went on to win the Super Bowl that year, but the win over the Raiders put Pittsburgh into the AFC Championship game against the undefeated Miami Dolphins. That's right, this was 1972. And what's interesting about that is the Dolphins had to travel to Pittsburgh to play the AFC Championship game. Even though they were undefeated, home field advantage in the playoffs wasn't determined by win-loss records back then. It rotated by division on an annual basis. The Dolphins, of course, ended up winning the AFC Championship game and Super Bowl VII. Now, on the same day as Franco Harris's famous catch, December 23rd, 1972, the NFC playoff game was the Dallas Cowboys at the San Francisco 49ers. And the 49ers took a 28-13 lead in the second half. Cowboys coach Tom Landry replaced his quarterback, Craig Morton, with Roger Staubach. Staubach ended up throwing two touchdowns in the last 2 minutes of the game, and the Cowboys beat the 49ers. Two amazing finishes back-to-back for everybody who's watching the NFL on that day. And it was three future Hall of Famers making the memories. You had Ken Stabler with that great run. Then you had Franco Harris's amazing catch. And then you had Roger Staubach's amazing comeback. And that was a few years before the Hail Mary. So that kind of helped establish the Roger Staubach late comeback legacy. 5 years later, on Christmas Eve of 1977, you also had two amazing playoff games on the same day. The first involved the Raiders playing at the Baltimore Colts, and the second involved the Steelers playing at the Denver Broncos. The Raiders at Colts game went into double overtime, and there were seven lead changes in regulation. The Colts had a 31-28 lead late in the game. The Raiders had the ball, and their head coach, John Madden, told Ken Stabler to take a look at Ghost to the Post, referring to Hall of Fame tight end Dave Casper, who had the nickname Ghost because of a well-known cartoon back then called Casper the Friendly Ghost. Dave Casper cut deep downfield towards the post. Stabler threw it high and closer to the sideline. Dave Casper chased it down between two defenders and caught the ball over his shoulder. The catch led to a Raiders game-tying field goal. On the NFL Today, Brent Musburger compared Dave Casper's catch to Willie Mays, making his famous over-the-shoulder catch in the 1954 World Series. The Raiders-Colts game went into double overtime, and Casper caught the game-winning touchdown, his third touchdown of the game, giving the Raiders a 37-31 victory. And at the time, it was the third longest game in league history. On that same Christmas Eve, 1977, another great game was played that evening. The Steelers at the Broncos. Tom Jackson, you likely know him as a TV analyst, he had a huge game at linebacker for the Broncos. He had two interceptions in the fourth quarter. Pittsburgh had tied the game at 21 in the fourth quarter, and then Denver kicked a field goal to take a three-point lead. And then Tom Jackson intercepted a Terry Bradshaw pass and ran it all the way back to the Steeler 9-yard line. But the Broncos could only get a field goal, and they led by only 6. The Steelers still had a good chance to win this game. But just before the 2-minute warning, Tom Jackson made another interception, and the Broncos scored a touchdown 2 plays later. And that 13-point fourth quarter, aided by 2 Jackson interceptions, gave the Broncos a 34-21 win, as Christmas Eve 1977 gave NFL fans 2 memorable games on the same day. The Raiders play at the Steelers this weekend. There were already plans in place to retire Franco Harris's number on the anniversary of the Immaculate Reception. It's going to be a memorable event for sure. And Franco Harris left us with just so many great memories, whether we were fans of the Steelers or not. I've got in my mind right now a picture of him scoring a touchdown in Super Bowl 13. I'm not old enough to remember the Immaculate Reception, but I definitely remember that one. And he was certainly one of those few NFL players that you could identify him just by his first name and everybody would know who you were talking about. There's Franco, there's Walter, Earl, Barry, Reggie. There are a few, but there aren't many. Franco was one of them. Coming up, an extended interview with Randy Cross. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Offensive lineman Randy Cross grew up in the Los Angeles area. He played college football at UCLA. In this interview clip, he discussed his deep UCLA roots and his first years with the San Francisco 49ers before Bill Walsh was hired. He'll also talk about what Bill Walsh first told him when he became head coach. I also asked Randy about the 49ers' comeback against the Saints. They were down 35-7 and rallied to win. That stood as the NFL's regular season record for the biggest comeback until the Vikings rallied from 33 points down to beat the Colts last week. The full interview will be posted on a later date on the Game Before the Money podcast. Here's 49ers center and guard Randy Cross.
You know, there were a whole series of coaches in my life that were based from UCLA or had their roots at UCLA. All 3 of my varsity high school coaches, my junior and senior year, played on the 66 Rose Bowl team. Terry Donahue, who was my offensive line coach at UCLA, was a teammate of those guys and was coaching at Kansas for Pep Rogers when he first was told about me. And that's when I first met him, when he was at Kansas, because at that time, let's say my sophomore year, I was a shot putter. And I was doing really well for a 10th grader. That's when I first met him, you know, as a Kansas offensive line coach. And going on, I mean, Bob McKittrick, who was my line coach for 10 years at San Francisco, coached with Tommy Prothro at UCLA. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's a web, but it's an organized web.
That is really interesting, because I did read that your high school varsity coach played on that Rose Bowl team, but it goes a lot deeper than that.
Yeah, and the thing that really helped me to talk about discipline was all those coaches. And there's an athletic director named Bill Leeds who first sort of identified my ability from a shot put standpoint and handed me over to another coach named Harry Welch. All those coaches and all those people kind of had one thing in common. They were extremely detail oriented, extremely attention to detail oriented and technique oriented. So everything I did, there was always a method to it, and there was a reason for it, and there were components to it that you could practice and practice and practice. And I got drilled into my head that old practice doesn't make perfect, perfect practice makes perfect. I heard that time after time after time after time, but in the end, it paid off.
So what's really interesting was, you know, Pepper Rogers, you had said, you know, was at Kansas when he first heard of you, and then he's coaching at UCLA. He was your first UCLA coach.
Yeah, he was an interesting guy. He was a salesman. He was one of the early coaches that did a lot of commercials, at least in L.A., that I just remember. You know, John McKay didn't do a lot of that stuff. John Wooden, obviously, didn't do a lot of that stuff. But Pepper was doing commercials for electronics stores and for furniture stores. And he was selling UCLA, and he was selling Pepper Rogers pretty hard. And it worked out great. I mean, it was an effective approach, but it was very unique at that time. He was also a hell of a football coach.
And then you had another great coach come in, Dick Vermeil. What do you remember when he first came in?
He coached for Tommy Prothrow, the ex-UCLA coach, at the LA Rams. And he was one of the first, and I, you know, people say this, you know, oh, no, it's not. Well, when he got hired, he was touted as the first special teams coach, special teams coordinator for the LA Rams. That's why he got hired. And he was, let's just say, young Dick Vermeil was as intense an individual as you could ever come across. Very, very intense. Very, very driven. And, you know, like I said, a whole series of people that were pretty amazing influences on my life.
Yeah, and what a great team accomplishment, you know, you guys had in that 76 Rose Bowl. You come in, Ohio State is ranked number one, and I don't think too many people gave you a chance, and you guys pulled it off. What do you think was the key in that?
Well, it always sounds weird to say it about games like that, but it was very important that we had history on our side. It had been exactly 10 years that the UCLA Bruins had played Michigan State in the Rose Bowl. And Michigan State was a number one team at that time.
That's right.
Supposedly
the 60s.
One of the greatest teams ever, blah, blah, blah. It was New Year's Day, 66. They beat Michigan State. So New Year's Day, 10 years later, and Donahue and my high school coaches, they were all on that team. 10 years later, we're in the Rose Bowl playing Ohio State, and they had beat the devil out of us at the Coliseum earlier in the year. Contrary to what people now think, you know, that UCLA has been playing at the Rose Bowl forever, the Coliseum was our home field. The only time you got to play in the Rose Bowl was in the Rose Bowl. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I only remember UCLA in the Rose Bowl for home games.
Right. No, it used to be the SC and UCLA both played in the Coliseum. So, yeah, that was a whole different deal there.
And then you went to San Francisco in the second round of 1976, and at first you had started at center.
Yeah, well, I played center and guard at UCLA. In fact, on my senior year, I haven't heard of this being done a whole lot. We had two offensive lines. We had one offensive line that I played right guard on, and that was our first line. And then we had our second offensive line. They'd come in after two series, and then we rotated every two series. So I played right guard on the first line, and I played center on the second line.
Wow, that's almost like a hockey team.
And I had started at center my sophomore year. So I played a lot of center early, and Monty Clark, who was my first pro coach, had been the offensive line coach for the Miami Dolphins, the perfect team in 72 and all that. And when he drafted me, he told me I was going to be his Jim Langer, who was all pro, you know, very famous Hall of Fame center.
Yeah,
For the Dolphins. In fact, to the point where I ended up wearing 62, which was Langer's number. At least that year. It's the only season from 73 on that I didn't wear 51.
Wow, and that was because Monty Clark pictured you as Jim Langer.
Yeah, he sold me pretty hard on that idea. Yeah, so that was it was a great time. It was an unbelievable opportunity. It was only there 1 year. We were 8-6. We didn't make the playoffs. So he got fired because Eddie DeBartolo bought the team in the offseason in 77, early 77. And he fired everybody in the organization, basically, and brought in a guy named Joe Thomas and started. It was a pretty traumatic series of events. I mean, when Bill Walsh got hired in 79, that was my fourth season. He was my fifth head coach.
Wow.
So people talk about, you know, change in the NFL and change in college and how, you know, you can't, it's unprecedented. No, sorry. They used to go through coaches like soiled underwear.
Well, Walsh comes in, it sounds like he not only brings stability, he brings that West Coast offense, and then he moves you to guard. Did he tell you right away, like, Randy, we're going to move you to guard, or what was that?
First time we met, right after he got hired, he said, let me show you my offense. He showed me some of the stuff he wanted to do, and he says, you're going to be my right guard. He goes, you're going to have to pull. You're going to run all game long. You're going to go both directions. You're an athlete. You can do that. And I went, okay, sure. No problem. Sounds like fun. And, you know, he was something. It wasn't easy. It wasn't instantaneous by any stretch of the imagination, because we went 2-14 again, which was an interesting combination. 1 year in 78, we had probably one of the worst teams in the history of the league at 2-14. And then the next year in 79, we're 2-14. It might be the best 2-14 team in NFL history. We had a lot of really good guys on it, a lot of good players. We weren't a very good team. And we didn't have any kind of a defense. But 6-10 in 80 was close, but no cigar. We lost a lot of real close games. And then things kind of changed a lot of lives in 81.
Yeah, well, and did that go back to 1980? I'm curious as to, you guys had that 35-7 comeback against New Orleans. Was that kind of a building block, maybe?
Yeah, it gets credit. I've always said that, you know, any genesis for all the comebacks, any genesis for always believing we were never out of a game and you could always make up whatever the deficit was sort of germinated in that game, you know, going in at halftime behind 35-7. We'll do that if you can come back and win. And, you know, we got to overtime and beat them 38-35. But, you know, that was, from an offensive standpoint, that was an amazing thing to be able to know that you could look at the scoreboard. And innumerable times after that, you know, we'd be down, like, let's say 10 points. And you'd look at the scoreboard and you'd say, okay, it's 7 minutes. Yeah, we'll get the ball two more times. We'll win by four. No problem. And we'll end up scoring. We'd end up scoring two touchdowns. But it was a lot of confidence born out of that.
I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money. Coming up, Randy Cross remembers Dwight Clark's famous catch and shares some 49er Super Bowl memories. Be sure to visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Back with Randy Cross, a standout offensive lineman for the Super Bowl champion San Francisco 49ers under head coach Bill Walsh.
In the 81 playoffs, I'm curious, because you guys first played the Giants, which was a 3-4 front with Lawrence Taylor and Harry Carson on the linebackers. And then in the NFC Championship, you're going up against Dallas in that 4-3 front with Randy White in the middle. What is the difference in the scheme for you guys?
Well, the 3-4 was something that was kind of new at that time. Well, at least it had been reintroduced as new. And people were playing a lot more odd fronts. So whether you're in a 3-4 or in a 4-3, one of the guards or both were uncovered with linebackers because of the odd front and the lineman being shifted. So that was kind of a common theme between the two.
Huh.
But Dallas had played a lot of predominantly vanilla 4-3 for a long time. And then they started playing what they called the flex. where one defensive tackle was really close to the ball and the other defensive tackle would be a couple yards off the ball. They were really, really good. The Giants, LT, that was LT's rookie year. And LT did everything. He was covering kicks. He was covering punts. He was on kickoff returns. He was doing everything for them. And that's the first time you really noticed LT was, you know, early in the week, you're watching special teams. Because I was always a long snapper and short snapper. You watch special teams going, who in the hell is 56? They're lining him up as the gunner on punt team and doing all this stuff with him. And he's just killing people.
Wow. And then, the 81 championship game, of course, the catch. And you're at right guard on the play. And you're moving with Montana. What was the call and what's your memory of that?
I had a good view, I know that. Sprint right option is the call. And it's a fairly quick roll pass that is supposed to be thrown about over the tight end. But if it's not immediately open, then he always had the carte blanche to move and stretch and try to see what he can make happen. Pretty special. I mean, Dallas fans to this day insist that he was throwing the ball away, but I wouldn't expect them to think anything else. But, they also didn't play offseason basketball with Dwight and Joe and know what great athletes they were and how they could jump and the things they could do. And those guys were really amazing. So when he threw that, I was like, it looked high, but I thought DC could get it.
Wow. And then the crowd just erupted. It was, when you think back, you guys had gone through those 2-14 seasons back to back. And then the next year you're 6-10. And then all of a sudden you're hosting the NFC Championship game and you come up with this incredible play. After the game, did you guys kind of acknowledge how far you had come, or was it just so all of a sudden?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, we were in what we kind of always referred to as next mode. We get done with the game and we never really dwelt much on the game that just ended. We were always dwelling on who was next, what was next. So, we're going to the Super Bowl. And for a bunch of guys that had been on some pretty bad teams, that was pretty cool, even if it was going to be in Detroit. You knew what you had accomplished, but no one was really dwelling on it because, we certainly didn't look at our work as done. It was a life-altering game, for sure, for a lot of people involved in it. But, at that time, there wasn't much time to dwell on it.
The 84 team, you went 15-1. Your only loss was by 3 points to the Steelers. Do you guys ever think about how close you were to the 72 Dolphins?
Yeah, I guess, to a degree. I mean, that was the first team to ever win 18 games, counting the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And the next year, the 85 Bears did it again. But, that context of, history is something that stuff's for, especially when you're in the moment, that's for sports writers. That's for talk show hosts. That's for all those people. Because when you're doing it, you don't have time to dwell on that stuff. It's, it's not negative energy, but it's definitely, those are calories burnt on something you got no control over.
Yeah, it's a distraction.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
In that Super Bowl, President Reagan did the coin toss. I saw you were at midfield. Mm-hmm. What was that like to have the president via satellite, and then you had Hugh McElhenney right next to you?
Yeah, no, it was pretty cool. It was, plus it was in our backyard. Everyone until last year, there a lot was made of, hey, the Rams are playing in their own stadium, blah, blah. That stadium at Stanford was a lot closer than Candlestick. I mean, a lot closer. That stadium at Stanford was probably like 3 miles from our facility in Redwood City. I would highly suggest anybody that plays in Super Bowls not have a home game if they can help it. It sounds dumb because if it happens and you're at a home game, it's supposedly a great advantage. But it was You have a lot more relatives, you have a lot more friends, you have a lot more acquaintances, you have a lot more everything when you have a home Super Bowl game.
That's right. You guys played the second Super Bowl against the Bengals, and you were playing center then in that game. So, you're reading the defense a bit more at the center position. Do you remember what the Bengals were doing there on that last drive, how their formations were?
As far as their defenses?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember them as being pretty much the same thing we'd seen during the game. You know, they were little reduction, a little pure 43-4. They had really good linebackers. They had very good physical, good-sized defensive linemen. They had lost their best defensive lineman, Tim Crumry, earlier in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was... They were a great defense. They were a really good defense. And they had a heck of a 16-3 with not much time left, and we had the ball on the 8-yard line. So they almost pulled it off because they had a touchdown on a kickoff return, which was very well timed on their behalf.
And then, of course, Montana makes the famous John Candy reference.
Mm-hmm.
Was that common for him to be kind of laid back in the huddle like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, he got that. That's what made me chuckle recently. I saw a headline on a magazine with a picture of Joe Burrow and it said Joe Cool. And I was like, wow, they had at least say two or again, or, that was Joe's thing. Joe was very, very poised. He suffered from sort of situational low blood pressure. He had the ability, his heart rate, and it would lower in big spots. Some people go the opposite way. Normal humans go the opposite way. He got, the bigger the spot, the cooler and the calmer he got.
Wow, that is amazing to hear that insight. You know, one thing about him is, or at least to me, he's one of the best clock management guys that I've ever seen. Late in the game. Was that something that you guys worked on as a team, or was that him in the moment?
That's something we worked on constantly. We were doing situational practice from the first day of mini camps to training camp to every day in practice. Every day of practice had a different emphasis and a different group of things and situations, whether it was short yardage, goal line, backed up, red zone, plus territory, minus territory, last 2 minutes, last 4 minute offense. There was always something that was tied into the clock and tied into a situation. And we constantly practiced those situations. And that's one of the reasons we were, I think, as good as we were, was Bill was always, some teams practice to practice. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're practicing your plays and you're practicing skills and things like that. I think now if you go to most major college football practices and NFL practices are now almost exclusively situational deals, where I'm not positive that was that unusual or that was unusual back then, where it wasn't quite the same. We did that constantly. So it was never anything unusual. When you got in the game and those situations came up, it was like, okay, we know what we're doing here.
And you guys felt comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Because
very comfortable.
Yeah, because you had practiced it before. And that Taylor play, was that something you guys ran often? I remember Walsh running a lot of slants with Taylor, it seemed like, in third down situations.
Yeah. Well, John was... people forget John started as a great punt returner, a kick returner, but then learned to be a great receiver. And that quick slant, that's the play that the game's remembered for. I remember the play a couple plays before that where the cornerback had a ball in his hands that was thrown right at him that he dropped.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go into almost every great memorable game and situation, and there's always that sort of thing that occurs. You know, when I'm talking groups-wise, I always like to talk about making unusual plays in ordinary circumstances, because everything's, if you practice things and repetitive, it's something you do all the time. It's like, how many times that defensive back's name is Lewis Billups, and how many times had a ball been thrown to Lewis Billups in practice that he caught it and took it back the other way, or he caught it and celebrated, but he always caught it. And in this situation, fairly normal, fairly typical, same thing happened and it didn't happen. And then a couple of plays later, bang, John Taylor hits him with that slant.
When you guys look back and reflect on it all, you know, what kind of goes through your mind? I mean, you guys, not too many people can say they were on one of the dynasties, and it's nobody can argue it.
Well, I mean, I think it made as much of a difference to the 49er fans. Back then, there was a group. They were called, and you see the term all the time now, they called the 49er Faithful. Well, the 49er Faithful weren't all 49er fans. The 49er Faithful were the ones that were always there. And whether we were a crappy team or a great team, those fans were, they'd come to a home game in the rain when it was cold, but they were there. Those were the people you were the happiest for.
Talking old school football there, Randy Cross. And that last statement he said kind of reminded me of Jerry Kramer when he was on the show talking about the Ice Bowl, Ray Nitschke leaving the field before that famous last drive of the Packers and saying, "Don't let me down." And Kramer saying that he realized the crowd was thinking the same thing after being out in the cold for so long, that those Packers and the 49ers had a lot in common, not strategy-wise necessarily, but preparation-wise and approach-wise. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Special thanks to Randy Cross for that great interview. Again, you'll be able to hear the full interview when it's posted on the Game Before the Money podcast after the first of the year. You can currently hear episodes featuring Dan Fouts, Tom Flores, Dick Vermeil, Jack Ham, and many more football legends on the Game Before the Money podcast, found wherever you listen to podcasts and at thegamebeforethemoney.com. Hall of Famer of the Week, it's got to be Franco Harris. Franco Harris grew up in New Jersey. He was a high school All-American there. He went to Penn State, was college teammates with running back Lydell Mitchell, who's also an outstanding NFL running back. He was also college teammates with Steelers Hall of Fame linebacker Jack Ham at Penn State. Franco Harris was drafted by the Steelers in the first round of the 1972 NFL draft. He gained over 1,000 yards rushing his rookie year, making him only the fifth player in pro football history to gain 1,000 yards rushing as a rookie. And that made him only the second Pittsburgh Steeler ever to have 1,000 yards rushing in a season. The first was Hall of Famer John Henry Johnson. Franco's rookie year was incredible. He had six straight 100-yard games, and that tied him with Jim Brown for the NFL record at the time. Also in his rookie season, he set the Steeler single-season touchdown rushing record, scoring 10 rushing touchdowns that year. He was the only rookie on the AFC Pro Bowl team, and he made the Pro Bowl each of his first 9 seasons. Franco Harris was named the most valuable player of Super Bowl IX. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1990. I'm Jackson Michael. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Wishing you all a very Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season.